With it being so close to Passover, I'm going to bring something related to that. And in the conversations I've had in the last couple of weeks, it's interesting to consider and talk and try to help people through various things that they're dealing with in life. It's interesting to see how God works with different people, the ways in which He will do that. It's also interesting, as I've been sending out the baptism cards, the anniversary cards that I started doing this year, it's been really enjoyable for me just to see some of, although it's from a distance and a little sterile, if you will, to see their history. I'm going to embarrass him a little bit. Mr. Mosh's 55th baptism anniversary was this past week, 1963. So we should all be so lucky and focused on God that we would stay with it for 55 years. But one of the things I've asked a number of people is, what is the story of your calling? You know, those are always interesting stories to hear because no two are ever alike. Even if you grew up in the same church area, the same home, it's never going to be the same. When did you first know that God was working with you, that you realized that God was opening your mind and showing you His truth and wanting you to do something with it? Maybe it was in some dramatic fashion. I've known people where they basically, figuratively I should say, get, you know, smacked in the face. God gets their attention. And for other people, it's that still small voice, you know, that they sort of hear and they start listening to. We have our collective stories as well as our individual stories. We have our congregational stories with our spiritual family. We have the extended stories of those faithful that have gone before, that we read of in Scripture, that we know of personally in our more recent history, that God has worked with and called down through mankind's history. And one such story that is always relevant this time of year, of course, is the Exodus as we approach Passover. God had decided to work with a people as opposed to primarily individuals, and He decided to do so through the family of Abraham. This was about 500 years before the Exodus account. Through his sons, through his grandsons, through their descendants, God took Israel to Egypt. And that in itself is a very interesting story. In working with Israel, we know that they were to become an example, that God was going to give them His truth. They were to live it and model it for others to see and hopefully to emulate. That will continue into the future. Israel didn't always do a very good job, especially later in their history. But nonetheless, that's what God had expected from them. Let's go back and read in Genesis 15 the account as God began to work with Abraham and telling him what He was going to do through their descendants. Most, even when they consider the Exodus account, don't consider how it was framed. That is, how God had that conversation with Abraham. As I said, it was almost 500 years prior to when they came out of captivity. But there is a direct connection that I want to consider in setting the stage for this today. In Genesis 15 and verse 7, God then says to Abraham, "I am the Eternal who brought you out of Ur of the Chaldeans to give you this land to inherit." And I think most of us are familiar with that story as God called Abraham. But even to consider how God was working with Abraham. If you remember the timeline that I've done, I don't think Abraham was disconnected from God's way of life and knowing who he was. I think there was a long family history there. But God then very directly began to work with Abraham. And so he says, Abraham does, to God, "How shall I know that I will inherit it?" And I don't think this is a question asked in a wrong attitude. This is just simply a query. Will you tell me this? How do I know? So God then says, "Bring me these things, a three-year-old heifer, a three-year-old family goat, a female goat, a three-year-old ram, a turtle dove, a young pigeon, and so forth." Abraham brings them to God. God cuts them in two, it says, down the middle, placed each piece on the opposite side except for the birds. Now, if you do any study on Old Testament, especially ancient covenants, this was one thing by which they would do. And later, both parties would walk between these things, and then they would share food, and they would have the commitment they would make to each other. What God is doing here is making a covenant with Abraham. Abraham would have understood the symbolism of these things. They didn't write contracts. They did things this way. And so then it says the sun was going down, a deep sleep fell upon Abram, and in this dream then he was fearful. Horror and great darkness fell on him, and God says in the dream to Abraham, "Know certainly that your descendants will be strangers in a land that is not theirs, and they will serve them. They will afflict them," meaning the nation in which Israel will find itself. Those people will afflict Israel, it says, for 400 years. "And also the nation whom they serve I will judge. Afterwards, they," meaning Abraham's descendants, "will come out with great possessions. Now as for you, you'll go to your fathers in peace. You'll die," God says, "in a peaceful manner. You shall be buried at a good old age. But in the fourth generation they shall return here, for the iniquity of the Amorites is not yet complete." And that's very interesting. God here is setting the stage not just for Abraham, not even just for his descendants, but also those that were currently in the land that God was still going to work with for a time. As an aside, this shows God's great mercy, that in spite of their sins, and they must have been great sins for God to even look 400 years down the road, that they needed to be corrected, but that he was going to give them 400 years to change or not. That's a whole different story, but it's an interesting aside here in all of this. But to remember back up in verse 13, that God tells Abraham how this is going to happen, that they're going to go into captivity, they're going to be basically slave people, but that God would deliver them. I believe that God allows us sometimes to suffer along with the world so that we can have God's truth reinforced, that we can see that stark contrast. We'll go into that a little bit more as we progress here. But I think a huge component of it as well is so that we will eventually get fed up with what this world has to offer, that we'll realize they don't have the answers, they don't have the solutions, and in most cases they don't even have a clue what to do. Most people just keep moving forward hoping something better will happen. But let's think about this a little bit in terms of this reference here in Genesis. If God knew the Amorites would be punished, why didn't he just do it then? Why did he have Israel go to Egypt until that punishment? He could have tucked Israel off in a little corner somewhere and just said, "Hold out here for a while, hang out, and then we'll take care of this here in a little bit." Also, if God knew that Egypt was going to be punished, why send Israel there to go into captivity and then punish Egypt at the end of it? Why not just address it? I don't have the specific answers, but in every case, I believe God is working with these people in the way that he knew best to interact with them. And what did either of these punishments, either with the Amorites or the Egyptians, have to do with Israel? Well, there are lessons there as well. God has always desired for mankind to see the truth of the matter, that only he is God. There is no other. Today we're going to take a look at Israel and the plagues of Egypt to consider a question. What God stands between us and the one true God? As we gather today here, just a few days from Passover, we need to consider what it means to come out of the world and to cease from sin. Now, the story of the Exodus is a wonderful account. It's been told in movies, it's told in books, it's been told down through time. I think a big part of why it's such a story people like to hear about, even non-religious people, is that it resonates because it's a story of the triumph of the underdogs. These people had been slaves for 400 years, and you know, in rides Moses with God's assistance through these amazing miracles and these plagues that are poured out, and they walk out with a high hand. And it is a very dramatic story in that regard. But there's more to it. There are many lessons that we can learn from this. We're reminded in John 17, as Christ gave his prayer to his Father that night before his crucifixion, that he reminded God, not that God needed to be reminded, but just to say it out loud, that we, those that would follow him, are not of the world. We're not. We can forget that until something like this upcoming week of unleavened bread comes along and you try to find matzo somewhere. And people say, "What's a matzo?" Or you show up at work with a matzo sandwich. That's an interesting conversation to have with somebody. We're different. We're supposed to be. We're set aside. We're not physically removed yet from the world, but we're still in it, and there's still evil in it. Maybe God does this so that we see the price and the consequence of sin. Perhaps it's to show the world a better way. Maybe we're the example, as Israel was supposed to be, to those few around us. And even if they don't change now, that maybe God will use that as an illustration down the road at some point in the future. But let's turn to the first verse there on the screen, Exodus 1 and verse 9. We'll set the stage here a little bit. God had heard the cries of Israel. He had not forgotten them. He was not leaving them without any hope. But from their timeline, if you will, from their perspective, they probably wondered if God was ever going to do anything, or if this was just the way it was going to be forever. In Exodus 1, verse 9 here, we come to the story of how they came into captivity. And the new ruler of Egypt, a change in dynasties, looked at all these people and became very concerned. It said, he said to his people, look, the people of the children of Israel are more and mightier than we are. Suddenly he realized there were more non-Egyptians in the land than Egyptians. And he says, come, let us deal shrewdly with them, meaning let's make sure they don't take advantage of us, lest they multiply and it happen in the event of war that they join our enemies and fight against us and so go up out of the land. And so they'd set taskmasters over them to afflict them with their burdens. And they built for Pharaoh supply cities of Pithom and Ramses. And so they become slaves. Verse 12, but the more that they were afflicted, the more they multiplied and grew, and they were in dread, the Egyptians, of the children of Israel. Now, I don't have lessons numbered here, but you can write these as we go through this. There's a great lesson in just this verse. God allows adversity to refine us. Mostly when we're punished, I believe, it's through our own fault. God is interested in perfecting us. And he can use situations such as this because we have other examples. In the book of Acts has got a number of these powerful examples that when there were times of great difficulty, God's people thrived spiritually, because they had their eye on what was important. And I believe this is one such case. To move to chapter 2 and verse 5, to pick up the story here, it says, the daughter of Pharaoh came down to bathe in the river, which she made a habit of. It says her maidens walked along the riverside. They probably did this to watch out for crocodiles or other animals such as that, hippopotamus. And it says, when she saw the ark among the reeds, she sent her maids to get it. Probably curious at first, what is this? Verse 6, she opened it and saw the child, and behold, the baby wept, and she had compassion on him and said, this is one of the Hebrew children. If you remember the account of earlier, Pharaoh was killing the young baby boys to reduce the threat he perceived. Moses' parents had put him in this reed basket under inspiration for God, and God spared him to lead his people. And so then in verse 7, they call for a nurse, and the story is that essentially his mother ended up being his own nurse, if you will. But in verse 10, to continue, it says, the child grew, and she brought him, she being Moses' real mother, brought him to Pharaoh's daughter, and he became her son. Moses became adopted into the Pharaonic family. And she, the daughter, called his name Moses, she says, because I drew him out of the water. And the Hebrew word has a similar expression, that he was rescued or drew out. And by this, then God was also going to draw out or rescue his people. And there's another lesson. He's doing the same with us. Look at our backgrounds. Look at our histories. Look at our lives. Some of us he calls very young. Some of he calls us when we're older. Some of us come from desperate backgrounds. Some of us come from more comfortable backgrounds. Some of us come from all kinds of histories. God, nonetheless, is drawing us out through our afflictions, not from our afflictions. To continue then in Exodus 4, as it is up there, Exodus 4 and verse 27, Moses, in the meantime, sees and hears God through the burning bush. God gives him direction. He had ended up there to begin with, Moses, because he had lost favor in the pharaonic court. He had to flee. He, after 40 years of living probably in the lap of luxury in Egypt, became a shepherd and probably learned a great deal about leading God's people by being a shepherd for 40 years. That's another sermon for another time. But in verse 27, to pick up the story, it says that the Eternal then said to Aaron, go to the wilderness and meet Moses. So God was bringing Moses back. He sent Aaron out to meet him. So Aaron went out to meet him on the mountain of God and kissed him. And Moses told Aaron all the words the Eternal had sent to him, all the signs which he had commanded him. It seems to be a couple of different things here. It could be signs that God showed Moses in the wilderness. It could be that God gave him a little bit of a vision of what he was going to do in Egypt. Nonetheless, whatever it was, Moses communicated this to Aaron, and then in verse 29, they went and gathered together the elders of the children of Israel, because now they have to show them, probably to convince them, to give them at least comfort to some degree of what God was going to do. They don't know Moses. Were many of them even alive when he left? If they were, did they remember him as a son of Pharaoh, wondering, what's this guy doing? So Aaron, then verse 30, speaks the words which the Eternal had given to Moses, and then he did the signs. There were, it seems, some miraculous things that God did through Moses and Aaron to convince the elders. And so the people believed. And when they heard that the Eternal had visited the children of Israel, that he had looked on their affliction, they bowed their heads and worshiped. In affliction, God can have our attention in a way that he will not any other time in life, because it puts things in perspective. And they understood this. They were probably beyond weary of being slaves. They were being broken like animals that someone didn't care for. And so then we move to chapter 5, as it's there on the screen, Exodus 5 and verse 1. Then Moses and Aaron went in and told Pharaoh, thus says the Eternal God of Israel, let my people go that they may hold a feast to me in the wilderness. Seems like a reasonable request. But from Pharaoh's perspective, his antenna goes up and he says, what are these people angling for? And so Pharaoh replies. And this shows the heart of Pharaoh here. Who is the Eternal that I should obey his voice to let him go? This was not a question of ignorance. This was a question of defiance. I'm a god. Pharaoh was the god in Egypt under Ra. He was a representation of all the gods of Egypt and deified as such. And he says, who? So verse 3, they said, the God of the Hebrews has met with us. Notice, please, let us go 3 days' journey into the desert to sacrifice to the Eternal God, lest he fall upon us with pestilence or the sword. And the king of Egypt said to them, Moses and Aaron, why are you wasting my time and the time of my workers? Go back to your labor. This is the first request. But why was God having Moses and Aaron ask Pharaoh's permission to begin with? Why not just make it happen? Well, there are lessons that Israel needs to learn, and there are certainly lessons that Egypt needs to learn. Remember what we read back in Genesis 15. God was going to address their behavior, their sins, their outlooks. They had some insight with the children of Israel living there to understand a certain level of God's expectations of behavior and worship. God could have had Israel leave Egypt in any number of fashions, any number of ways. But I believe firmly that God wanted to expose Pharaoh and consequently the people of Egypt to the fact that these were just false gods, all of them. And so we set the stage. And in verse 2, as it read there, he has this defiant question. Who is this God? This is no God. And in many ways, he throws down a gauntlet here. Egypt had so many gods, as we will see, that they attached to almost every aspect of their life. And a lot of it we would shake our heads at and say, what? But they were serious about this. But here we see the first God that the eternal God challenged. God was going to challenge Pharaoh throughout this whole thing and show him to be a false god. And God basically says, okay, you want a challenge? A challenge it is. Now, bear in mind that Pharaoh was not the same class as the rest of the people. As I mentioned, he was viewed as God. Not only in this life, but as is testament in the many burial chambers and even the pyramids that have been opened, in the afterlife, he maintained that status as a god. But while he was alive, he ruled on earth as the physical leader of all the gods of Egypt. And God is not without his sense of humor, but he's also not without his sense of completeness in that he finishes the plagues with a very direct and costly answer to Pharaoh. We'll see that as well. God is judging Egypt, remember. That's what he told Abraham he would do. They were worshiping everything but the eternal God. And they did have access, as I said, to God through Jacob and the rest of the children of Israel when they came to Egypt, but they failed to respond to it. So, God here makes a statement, as he said to Moses back in Exodus 3, when he said, Moses, to God, who are you that I can tell the children of Israel? And he says, I am that I am, the eternal that is eternal, the self-existent that is self-existent. Now, as we'll see here, Israel suffered along with Egypt for a time. And that's an interesting question as well. Why? But keep in mind through all this that Egypt is a type of the world in general. And so let's read the last verse on that screen there, Exodus 5, and in verse 15 we'll pick up. So then the officers of the children of Israel came and cried to Pharaoh. Pharaoh had changed the terms of their servitude, if you will. Now, he said, well, if they have so much time to go in the wilderness and worship this God I don't know, then I must not be working them hard enough so they can get their own straw. And so then as they were divided up, these officers come to him and they say, why are you dealing with us this way? And then Pharaoh says, or they say, there was no straw given to your servants. And they say to us, make brick. And indeed your servants are beaten, but the fault is in your own people. And he said, no. You have enough time. You're wasting my time. So you say, let's go and sacrifice to the eternal. If you have that much time, therefore, go now and work. No straw will be given, yet you shall deliver the same quota of bricks. I don't want to see one less brick. And so then what do you think the officers of the children of Israel did? They didn't argue with Pharaoh. They go to Moses and they said, what have you done? Verse 20, they came out from Pharaoh, they met Moses and Aaron who stood there to meet them, and they said, let the Lord look on you and judge you. By way of contrast, depending on how your Bible is laid out, look at the paragraph across the page, the end of verse or chapter 4. There's already a stark difference in attitude here from worshiping God to blaming Moses and Aaron. Nonetheless, God's going to walk them out of this. But they had become comfortable with being slaves. Now, I can almost guarantee you, they were longing for the good old days when they didn't have to gather straw for their bricks. They didn't say, ask God to deliver us quickly. They said, why did you do this? Many times we become too comfortable with sin. And I think that's a lesson in here as well. We get so used to the world around us. We get so used to the way businesses operate. We get so used to the politics of the world that it doesn't really concern us. But even our former life, do we miss the things God brought us out of? Whether it's Christmas or other false celebrations or eating things that are not really food or being able to work overtime on Friday night or Saturday or any number of things. I know, unfortunately, too many people, as I suspect most of you do, that have said at some point, I'm done. And they walk away from what God is offering. If we're not careful, we can become comfortable in satisfying our wants. But God here is showing Israel, he's showing us that the world doesn't have true comfort. That's not where they should look. So God begins to address this. And so we move to chapter 7 and verse 1. And it says, God says to Moses, see, I've made you as a god to Pharaoh. He's not making Moses a god. He's making him a god to Pharaoh, meaning he will look like a god that Pharaoh would understand. And Aaron your brother shall be your prophet, your spokesman. You will speak all that I command you, and Aaron your brother shall tell Pharaoh to send the children of Israel out of the land. Moses, what God means here, would be far more powerful a god than Pharaoh could ever dream of being. And so then to continue in verse 3, God says, I will harden Pharaoh's heart. What God is going to do is work with Pharaoh's attitudes. Pharaoh could either comply, or as we'll see, he's going to rebel. God's going to magnify one or the other. He knows in advance, though, pretty good idea, what Pharaoh's going to do. He says, I will multiply my signs and my wonders in the land of Egypt, but Pharaoh will not heed you. So again, why do this? I think it's because he needed to show Pharaoh beyond a shadow of a doubt, you're not who you think you are, and your gods are not who you think they are. Notice it goes back to what it says, what God said to Abraham, my armies and my people, the children of Israel, you're to let them go, he says, out of Egypt by great judgments, and the Egyptians shall know that I am the Eternal when I stretch out my hand on Egypt and bring out the children of Israel from among them. And so God begins to do this. And so verse 6, Moses and Aaron went and did as God commanded them to. One of the very first things then that God addresses here is the water that turns to blood. We read of that in verse 14 through verse 24. Why did God start there? When I read this account, as we'll read here in these next couple of chapters, what I see here is God systematically dismantling every god of Egypt and showing not only Egypt but Israel exactly how impotent every one of them is. They are powerless to stop him. In spite of Egypt worshiping them, saying they could. And so then God, in verse 14, says to Moses to go out when Aaron goes out in the morning. Verse 15, when he goes out to the water, stand by the bank, and the rod that I gave you that you used previously to turn into a snake that ate the snakes that were turned from rods of the magicians. He says, take that same rod, and he says, declare these things. Verse 16, the eternal God of the Hebrews has sent me to you. Excuse me. He has sent me to you, saying, let my people go that they may serve me in the wilderness. But indeed, until now, you have not heard. So, God says, by this you shall know that I am the Eternal. I will strike the waters of the river with a rod that is in my hand, and it shall be turned to blood. The Nile was the lifeblood of the land. When it flooded every spring, it replenished the fields with new soil. It had been washed down from thousands of miles upstream. The water itself was life-sustaining. They could irrigate everything with it. Everything flowed from the Nile. If they didn't have the Nile, they could never live there. And so God starts striking at the heart of one of their primary gods. And as you see on the screen there, a representation of gods that were called Hapi and Knum. They were the water god and the Nile god. So, as such, these gods should have protected the water. They should have protected the Nile. And God throws down a challenge. In this case, we know by referencing Leviticus 17:11, God tells us that life is in the blood. That's why we don't eat the blood. It's sacred to God. But in this case, he was taking something that was sacred to the Egyptians and he was making it an affront to them. Because as we continue here in verse 18, it says, "The fish that are in the river shall die." This was not just red clay that fell into the waters upstream. This was something that caused everything to die in it. And when they died, it said, "The river shall stink, and the Egyptians will loathe to drink the water," which is no small understatement. Would you drink something as foul as rotting blood water? And so God shows them. They're powerless to stop this. Verse 20, Moses and Aaron do as God said. They lifted their rod. They struck the waters. It turns to blood. It says the fish died in verse 21. The river stank. The Egyptians couldn't drink the water from the river or throughout all the land. So even those that will try to explain away this was, you know, something in the water, not a miracle, how do you explain all the water in the rest of the land? Verse 24, they dug all around the river, but they couldn't find anything to drink. It was all blood. Then we move next to the goddess of fertility, Heket. We come to the second plague of frogs. It always seemed a curious thing. Why frogs? Well, in chapter 8 and verse 1, God tells Moses, "Go to Pharaoh and say to him, 'Thus says the Eternal, let my people go.'" God never wavered in this. He asked the same thing from the beginning. Pharaoh digs his heels in, verse 2, "But if you refuse to let them go," God now starts putting bite behind it, "behold, I will smite all your territory with frogs. So the river shall bring forth frogs abundantly. And when you go up and come into your house, in your bedroom, in your bed, in your houses, or your servants, on your people, or in your ovens, your kneading bowls, everywhere you turn, you're going to find frogs." My mom, when I was still a boy living at home, refused to clean pockets out. So if a pair of pants went into the laundry, it didn't matter what was in it, it went through the laundry. Because she got tired of reaching into pockets and finding dead frogs. We had frogs all over our property. I don't know why. We always found them fascinating. Stick them in our pockets thinking we were going to do something with them later. And forgot all about them and they would die. She got tired of pulling dead frogs out of the pockets. So she just said, "Okay, you can deal with it." So to continue in verse 6 here, Aaron stretches out his hands. The frogs come up. But notice in verse 7, the magicians can replicate this. But interestingly, they cannot stop it. And so Pharaoh calls for Moses and Aaron and begs for them to go to God. It says that he can take away the frogs from the land of my people. And he lies. "And I will let the people go that they may sacrifice." And verse 9, then Moses tells him, "I know you're lying, but you remember that you're lying. There is no one like the Eternal Lord God. The frogs will depart from you." In 11, they're going to remain in the river only. Moses and Aaron go out. They cried to the Eternal, the frogs he had brought against Pharaoh, and God did according to the words of Moses. But notice how he did this. This is why I say God is not without his sense of humor. He did what Pharaoh asked, but he left them where they were. It says they died in the houses, in the courtyards, in the fields. They gathered in the heaps and they stank. Now, why was it frogs? I asked that question. The goddess Hekt, it could be, or Heket, was a toad goddess. And as such, she was seen as a guardian of the land. She was the wife of the god Khnum. Frogs were symbolizing resurrection and procreative powers. And God says, "If that's what you want, I will give it to you until you're sick of them." In fact, frogs were consecrated to Osiris. They were a symbol of inspiration. The Greeks had the owls. For some reason, the Egyptians had the frog. In fact, in Egypt, killing a frog was punishable by death. That's how deeply they worshiped them. And God says, they're powerless. I'll make you repulsed by them. In John 11, Christ alone says that I am the resurrection and life. Life only comes from him. God then moves on, knowing that Pharaoh has hardened his heart. And here we have the gods Kepher and Geb. Kepher was the god of rebirth. He was also connected to the creation. Geb was the god of vegetation. They were supposed to protect these areas. To continue in verse 16 of chapter 8, God then says to Moses, tell Aaron, stretch out your rod, strike the dust of the land that it may become lice. Why this again? We can think these are sort of arbitrary things as we read through these accounts that God is doing, but I believe there are very specific reasons why he's choosing these things. But he tells him, strike the dust of the land that it becomes lice. Verse 17, they do so. He stretches out his hands and it afflicts everybody, man and beast. All the dust of the land became lice. Verse 18, the magicians so worked with their enchantments to bring forth lice, but they could not. They had finally met their match. And they tell Pharaoh, this is the finger of God. This is beyond our ability. But Pharaoh's heart grew hard, and he didn't heed them. The magicians of Pharaoh here were out of the contest at this point, and God's actions against the god Kepher. Kepher was also a god of the beetles and flies, which again seems odd. But in that area of the world, you have the scarab beetle. Some call it also the dung beetle. And they'll recycle this material. So this is why you have the rebirth aspect of it all. Geb, being the god of earth and vegetation, was supposed to watch out for the land and the things in it. This will come back later as well. But the movement from one plague to another follows this steady progression of debasing the gods of Egypt, one after the other. Because we're told in Romans 1, verses 18 to 25, we are not to worship the creation. We're to worship the Creator. And so then we come to the fourth plague. And this plague is insects. The god is Kepher. Exodus 8, verse 20, then we pick up the story. It says, the eternal God said to Moses, rise early in the morning, stand before Pharaoh as he comes out of the water, and say to him, thus says the eternal, let my people go. Same thing again. Or else, if you will not let them go, behold, I will send swarms of flies on you. Which even goes back to Geb. But now he's touching on Kepher. Kepher was also a creator god. Some have said these are not necessarily just flies, that it could also be insects in general. But whatever the case is, God says this is what's going to happen. I'm going to send swarms of these on you and your servants, your people, and your houses. The Egyptians will be inundated with it. It's going to cover the ground. Verse 22, that day, notice, God says, I will set apart the land of Goshen. What was in Goshen? Children of Israel. Up until this point, they're suffering with Egypt in these things. They're probably even more mad at Aaron and Moses. What have you gotten us into? Are you serious? The bricks and everything were bad enough, but now there's no water to drink. These lice are just killing us here. Now flies? But God says, I'm going to set them apart. How long do we suffer with the world before God sets us apart? He's going to at some point. That's in the future. For now, we're suffering with the world. Do we see the gods of this world are impotent? The actions of mankind will never solve their own problems. The turning away from God is not the answer. And so then God continues, verse 24. Thick swarms of flies came into the house of Pharaoh, his servants' houses, all the land. It was corrupted. The land was compromised. There were flies everywhere, in the water probably, in the food. Every place you turned, every place you walked, there were flies. Pharaoh then calls for Moses and Aaron, verse 25, and says, go sacrifice to your God. And Moses says it's not right to do so, for we'd be sacrificing the abomination. Because what Moses realizes here is that Pharaoh is not saying go 3 days and sacrifice. He says go do it here, thinking that will appease God. He says, Moses says, no, we need to go out. Verse 27, 3 days' journey. Pharaoh says, I will let you go that you may sacrifice to your God in the wilderness, only don't go very far away. I'm not going to let you go 3 days. Can you imagine after these four plagues, Pharaoh is so entrenched here that he's bargaining with someone who can simply crush him if he wants to. But let Pharaoh not deal deceitfully. The middle of verse 29. Moses knows exactly who he's dealing with here. So Moses goes out from Pharaoh. He entreats God. God does according to the word of Moses, verse 31. But Pharaoh again returns, verse 32, to hardening his heart. In Exodus 19, verse 5, God called Israel His special treasure. We are of the same category when we obey God. And obeying God brings blessings. Even if we're surrounded by trials, even if we're surrounded by the consequences of sin in the world, to the point that God reminds us in Revelation 18:4 to come out of her, to come out of the world. That's at the heart of our calling, to no longer be like the world, to think like them, to act like them, to behave like them. And so then God continues, and we come to the fifth plague, the death of the livestock. Egypt had a goddess named Hathor. Hathor was the goddess of fertility. She was also considered the goddess of motherhood, by extension, birth. She was also the wife of the sacred bull god Bolchus. This is part of why God hated so much when they established the golden calf. They were going back to this. It was an extreme affront to God. So in chapter 9, God tells Moses, go to Pharaoh, tell him, let my people go. If you refuse to let them go, verse 2, and still hold them, behold, the land will be... God's hand will be on the cattle of the field, the horses, the donkeys, the camels, the oxen, the sheep, a severe pestilence. This was Hathor's responsibility to protect this life. The bull was considered a symbol of fertility as well in the land of Egypt. Verse 4, the Eternal will make a difference between the livestock of Israel and the livestock of Egypt. Now he's not only separating the people, he's separating the property. He says, though the animals in Goshen, they're not going to go through any of this. Nothing shall die of all that belongs to the children of Israel. And so God appointed a time saying, tomorrow the Eternal will do the thing in this land. And in spite of this, notice the mercy God is giving Pharaoh. Did he give him this time to perhaps rethink his position, to let his heart soften some, to come back to God and said, you know, I've rethought this, and if you would be so kind. But the next day comes, verse 6, God does this, all the livestock of Egypt died. But of the livestock of the children of Israel, not one died. How much wealth was lost in that one day for the Egyptians? Pharaoh then sent, and indeed not only one of the livestock of Israel was dead. He didn't believe it. Even though God told him this would be the case, he wanted verification. But Pharaoh hardened his heart. He wouldn't let the people go. The increase comes from God. Hosea 2, verses 14 to 18. God says, I give the increase. As much as they wanted to worship goddesses like Hathor, God in a moment took away everything they thought they increased. And so then God moves on. And we come to the next set of gods, not the only ones. I'm simply highlighting some of these as we move along. Khons was the moon god. Thoth protected physicians. So let's pick up the story in verse 8. Exodus 9, God then tells Moses and Aaron, take for yourself handfuls of ashes from the furnace and let Moses scatter it towards the heaven in the sight of Pharaoh, and it will become fine dust in all the land. And again, dust seems like an odd thing to do. But this dust, notice, was to create boils that break out in sores on man and beast. Any livestock still alive faced the same agony that the men did. Boils are terrible things. Ask Job. The pain from one can be overwhelming. But to have your body covered in them? And so Moses and Aaron do this. Verse 10, they took the ashes, they stood before Pharaoh, they scattered it to the heavens, and it caused boils to break out and sores on man and beast. And the magicians could not stand before Moses. Not just because they couldn't replicate this, but it says here, because the boils were on them as well. But God allowed Pharaoh to harden his heart against, this is also against the god Imhotep. Imhotep was the physician god of intelligence and wisdom. He was also a god of healing. But again, this dust connection is very interesting. When people go through Egypt's history, they always laud the achievements. They look at the monuments. They look at the things they built. They look at what they put together in terms of a civilization. But they rarely peek behind the curtain and see what was going on in the everyday life of what they were doing. And this touches on this. On special occasions, there would be human sacrifices to these medical deities. These people were literally burnt alive, and then they would take the ashes of them, they would scatter them in the wind before the people. And as these ashes descended upon the people, they would claim a blessing upon Pharaoh and the people. God says, you think this is a blessing? I'll give you boils and see if you still think this is a blessing. Psalm 103, verse 3. God says, I am the one who heals you. We can go to doctors, and there's nothing wrong with that. There's a certain wisdom and knowledge and understanding they have. But they do not heal us. Only God can do that. Moving along then, we come to Exodus 9 and verse 18. It says here then, they went out from, excuse me, wrong section, 9 verse 18. We have hail that comes on the scene. God, again, going back to 13, tells Moses, rise up early when you see Pharaoh do these things. I'm going to send this to him. So in verse 18, God, through Moses, tells Pharaoh, tomorrow about this time, I will cause a very heavy hail to rain down, such as never been seen in Egypt. Now, I don't know if you've ever been in a hailstorm. Pea-sized hail hurt. They're like little stones being thrown at you. Anything above a golf ball is really going to do damage. And there have been recorded instances of softball size, and you're destroying things at that point. God makes a just fantastic display here because he says, he gives them a warning, verse 19, gather everybody in the field, all your livestock, if you want them to live. That's how heavy these pieces of hail are going to be and how long it's going to last. Nothing will be alive. And as we read through the account, some of the house of Pharaoh listened, but many did not. And it says, verse 21, but he who did not regard the word of the Eternal left his servants and his livestock in the field. The inference is they died. God says to Moses, stretch out your hand. Verse 22, there's going to be hail in all the land, on every man, beast, and every plant. And so we have these gods here, goddesses. Nut, N-O-O-T, even though it's N-U-T in the spelling would be the way to pronounce it. Nut was the goddess of the sky. Bad weather like this was not supposed to happen with Nut on the job. And yet she couldn't stop it. The other goddess there is Osiris. This is one of the triune gods in Egypt's pantheon. She was the goddess of life. All these men, all these animals that die because she can't protect them. And so then we move on to the next plague. And this is the plague of locusts. Chapter 10, verse 1, God tells Moses, go to Pharaoh. I've hardened his heart even more. I've allowed him to become even more dug in on all of this because I want him to see the signs I give him. Even if he doesn't change, he's going to know that I am God. Also, verse 2, that you will tell your descendants the things I have done, the signs I have shown them, that you will know. It's a hard thing to come before God and ask for something and not have it happen right away. And it doesn't mean that God's not listening and God doesn't care. But being human, we want things now. If my arm is broken and I ask God to heal it, I don't want to be in a cast for 6 months. And we can laugh at that, but it's not really a laughing matter. I'm not making fun of it. Sometimes God allows these things for us to learn a lesson. It is no different than what he's walking Israel through here. He wants us to know. And I'll tell you, the times when God does directly answer prayer, going back to how the elders responded to Moses, should make us stop and worship God in a way we didn't before. And I've been part just a few times when God has dramatically and directly answered a prayer as I'm praying it for someone. And I tell you what, it makes the hair stand up on the back of my neck to know God can be that directly involved. But even in minor ways, we should never overlook those things, the deliverance God gives us on a daily basis. And if you drive on the highway, you cannot take that for granted. God wanted Israel to know, he wanted Egypt to know that he is God. And so then in chapter 10, if I'm on the right spot here, I haven't lost my place, he brings on this plague of locusts. So from verse 1 to verse 20, we have all this account. He tells them, I'm going to send them so thick, they're going to blot out the sun. They're going to cover everything on the ground. You're not going to be able to see anything that's not covered in locusts. Verse 5, they're going to eat what was left. What the hail didn't pound into the ground, the locusts are going to eat. They're going to fill your houses. Verse 6, you're going to be stepping on them, sitting on them. They're going to be in your food. They're going to be everywhere. And then Pharaoh's servants, they're starting to get fed up with this. It only took 7 previous plagues. But they're basically now going to Pharaoh and saying, look, how long are we going to have to put up with this? Let this guy go. I mean, think about, they've lost livestock. They've lost food sources. They had to deal with not having water, the boils, everything they've been through. Let them go that they may serve the eternal their God. Do you not know that Egypt is destroyed? Have you not looked out your window and seen what's going on? So Pharaoh calls for Moses and Aaron. God didn't have to tell them to go this time. Pharaoh calls them and he says, go serve the eternal God. Who are the ones that are going? He's still in a mindset to bargain here. Moses is being bold here. He says, we're going to go out with everyone and everything. And then verse 10, he says, the Lord had better be with you when I let you and your little ones go. This is, excuse me, Pharaoh. Not so. Go now, you who are men, serve the eternal. He's basically saying, no, your wives and children are going to stay here. Your men can go. God then tells Moses, stretch out your hand over the land for the locusts that they may come. Okay, we're not making any progress here, God says. Let's just go ahead and bring the locusts in. So Moses does. Verse 14, the locusts come up all over the land after this wind has been blowing, and they were everywhere. They covered the face of the whole earth, verse 15. The land was darkened. I think it was back in the early 1800s, we had a plague of locusts go across what we know as America now. And they did essentially what God describes here. It blackened the sky, those that saw it, stripped the land of everything. And miraculously, they just died out. And we've never seen anything like it since. Moses goes before Pharaoh in verse 16. And notice Pharaoh's words. Pharaoh says the right words, but his heart hasn't changed. He says, I have sinned against the eternal your God and against you. Therefore, please forgive my sin only this once. How many plagues have we gone through here? How many times has he lied? How many times has he promised? How many times has he said okay? But nonetheless, God responds. Verse 19, he turns a strong wind the opposite direction, west wind, drives them all away into the Red Sea. Not one of them remained in the land of Egypt. But Pharaoh's heart is still hard. And so then we come down to the conclusion of the matter. And we have the 10th plague. And this is covered in the next two chapters, chapters 11 and 12. And we're not going to read all of those. You know that story. But Israel had become too comfortable in Egypt. To a large degree, they had probably forgotten God in almost every way. They were learning as much about God and all of this as Egypt was. And I have to wonder what they thought as they looked from Goshen back down into Egypt and they saw the last seven plagues afflict Egypt. And they must have been paying attention because they put the blood on the doorpost. And we don't hear any grumbling, any questioning, any dragging of the feet to do that. And I bet the next morning every one of them were so thankful they listened. Because death went on the land. And I have represented there on the screen the gods Ra, Osiris, and Isis, the god and goddesses. These were the primary gods. Ra was the god of the gods. He was the father of all gods. He was the god of the sun. He was the god that represented every other god in every other way. Pharaoh, by extension, represented Ra. He was Ra on earth. He was the incarnation of Ra, Osiris, and Isis. Pharaoh was ruling on earth before the gods and considered to be an extension of all the gods. And God says, I will take from you what you cannot stop me from doing. The most precious thing you have, your firstborn. All along the way, Pharaoh offered compromises to God's requests. There are no compromises to God's way of life. To compromise spiritual truth is to compromise God's way of living. And every time Pharaoh sought to compromise, God came back with the same thing. Let my people go 3 days into the wilderness. Our response to sin should always be the same. God has required and asked of us and instructed us to live righteously before him. Let's turn to Exodus 10 and read verse 1 again. Notice why God did this. God says to Moses, go into Pharaoh. I have allowed his heart to be hardened, the hearts of his servants, that I may show these signs of mine before them. They are going to have no doubt that I am God. Whether they want to listen to me or obey me doesn't matter at this point. They will know. And then verse 2, that you may tell in the hearing of your sons and your sons' sons the mighty things I have done in Egypt, the signs that I have done before them, that you may know that I am the Eternal. I have said on other occasions, and I encourage everybody to do this, tell your stories, what God has done in your life. There is no small thing when it comes to what God does with us and for us. Exodus 49 there says a very similar thing. I'm sorry, I didn't have that on the screen. Exodus 49, verses 9 to 10. God says, I am God and there is none like me. As I've said before, sometimes God allows us to go through these things, not only in our own lives, but what we see in the world around us, so that we're a witness to the price of sin, so that we're more fully reminded that God is eternal, that there is none like him. We're to be reminded of this as we come up on the days of unleavened bread. What sin, what God stands before us and the one true God? What are we going to hold on to that we say, no, this one we will allow? Will we be reminded of it during the days of unleavened bread? The plagues of Egypt were more than a mechanism for deliverance. As I said, God could have done that any number of ways. They were there for Egypt's punishment. Those plagues that God allowed were in part as a fulfillment of what God said to Abraham. I am going to judge them. These gods are worthless. In fact, God was showing great restraint. If we go back to chapter 9 and verse 15, he says here, if I had stretched out my hand and struck you and your people with pestilence, then you would have been cut off from the earth. You wouldn't have stood a chance if I really wanted to extract my judgment. Verse 16, but indeed for this purpose I have raised you up, that I may show my power in you. And people, whether they understand the lessons or not, still talk about this story to this day, don't they? My name will be declared in all the earth. And this will happen again in the end time. Everyone will know. This was all the crucible that God used to make Israel a nation. Because they were not beforehand. They were slaves. They had no experience in governing. They had no experience in business. They had no experience in life. They were told what to do from the time they got up to the time they went to bed. And God made them a nation. They became a holy nation with his laws, statutes, and judgments. And they didn't always do very well at it. But it doesn't take away from what God wanted to do through them. They had access to a way of life that would bring blessings. Do we understand that? And do we live it, even if they didn't? They were to be an example of all of those things before the world. Are we an example? The biggest evangelistic campaign we can do is our life. Do we live what we preach? We can go through trials in this world. We can suffer through the sins of the world around us, the bad government, the bad business, the wars, the greed, everything that comes along with this, the worship of the false gods replete in the world around us. As much as they want to deny it, it's there. All that sin bears fruit. Not good fruit, but it bears fruit. God could simply remove us, but he doesn't. He could have simply removed Israel, but he didn't. There were lessons he wanted them to see and learn. There are lessons for us to see and learn. Will we reject sin? Will we reject the lie in the garden that we are gods apart from the God? Let's go back to Exodus 5 as I conclude here. Exodus 5 and verse 2. Pharaoh answered Moses, and he said, as we remember at the beginning of this message, who is the Eternal that I should obey him, that I should listen to his voice to let Israel go? I don't know the Eternal, and I'm not going to do what you have asked. If we flip this around, this is the Eternal we know. This is the one that we should listen to. This is the God whom we should obey. If you want to do a little extra reading this week, I would encourage you to read 1 Corinthians 10, the first 13 verses. Paul uses what Israel went through as an example. He said they were an example to us. We were to learn from what they went through, and especially learn the lessons that they did not. But by the time Israel saw the conclusion of these plagues on Egypt, I can only imagine how eager they were to leave. They were done with Egypt. It said they went out with a high hand, at least for a time. But they were excited. They were done with Egypt. How about us? Are we done with the world? Are we done with sin? Are there still gods, little g, are there still gods that have not been vanquished yet that hold our interest? The calling of a Christian is all about coming out of sin, and we're not there yet. It's a process. But we're like Israel enduring the first three plagues with Egypt. There's still not a separation physically from the world around us, and perhaps God is allowing us to be tired of man's ways, to realize there are no answers in this life. And I believe firmly that God is refining his bride for his son. We face some tough things. There are people with tough things in their lives. Alzheimer's and dementia that's leading to death. Serious health issues. Serious relationship issues. Financial issues. And I only highlight to say that God is leading us through these things for a purpose. And I believe part of the purpose is for us to see how ineffective we are and how ineffective man's solutions are. Only God has the answer. Only God can deliver us. Only God can help us overcome. Now is the time to come out of the world. Now is the time to come out of sin. So let's remember the lessons of the Exodus. Let's look forward to the time of our true spiritual Exodus.